Tuesday, February 27th, 2007. We have three bills on the agenda today, and I do want to say at the beginning, and then I'll say it again at the end, that we are meeting on Thursday. I believe we have something like four bills or so that will show on the schedule, and I'll announce those at the end. But today we have three, and I think we will start with Senator Pretner Solon. If you are ready with Senate File 140. And members, you have all the materials in your packet.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson? The bill that, do we have a cart where we can put those?
Thank you, Marnie.
Thank you. Okay, if anybody wants to get anything.
Put that down there on the cart.
Okay. Senator Pretner Solon, presenting a bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is the longest table I've ever sat at the end of.
It's a long
one. Can you hear me down there?
We can barely see you, but we know you're there. Yes.
I'd like to thank Senator Scheid for allowing me to present Senate File 140, the Restroom Access Act, before the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. This bill is designed primarily to provide access to private restroom facilities and public places of business for individuals with fecal or urinary incontinence due to a medical condition. One of the more common medical conditions affiliated with this symptom is Crohn's disease. And Crohn's disease is an inflammatory bowel disease, a chronic disorder that causes inflammation of the digestive or gastrointestinal tract, most commonly affecting the small intestine and colon. To give you a better picture of how widespread this disease is, it is estimated that as many as 1.4 million Americans have irritable bowel syndrome at an annual medical cost of $2 billion. Crohn's disease primarily affects adolescents and young adults, ages 15 to 35, and it is estimated that 140,000 children under the age of 18 suffer from Crohn's disease in the United States. Additionally, patients with severe irritable bowel syndrome may need to use the restroom up to 20 times per day. The language in Senate File 140 is modeled after a bill passed in Illinois 2 years ago after a teenager with Crohn's disease was refused bathroom access in an Old Navy store and suffered an embarrassing accident as a result. The Illinois bill was passed unanimously. Moreover, since passage in Illinois, there have been no negative consequences or problems with the Restroom Access Act for the retailers. To put it simply, the Restroom Access Act requires a retail establishment that has a toilet facility for its employees to allow a customer to use that facility during business hours if the following criteria are met. First, the customer requesting the use of the employee toilet facility suffers from Crohn's disease, colitis, or an eligible medical condition. Three or more employees are working at the time. The retail establishment does not already make a restroom available to the public. And the access to a toilet facility is not located in an area that would create a health or safety risk to the customer, and a public restroom is not available. Furthermore, the retail establishment or an employee would not be liable for any act or omission in allowing a customer to use an employee toilet facility. Also, retail establishments are not required to make any physical changes to a toilet facility to accommodate the provisions of this bill. Ensuring restroom access to people with Crohn's and colitis is a common sense solution that will be good for business because these people will have the freedom to patron these retail establishments when they know they will have access to a restroom. The Restroom Access Act is an extension of customer service. It is not going to be every customer. It will be a few customers with special needs who otherwise might not be shopping in the establishment. Individuals with these medical issues resort to staying at home where restroom access is not an issue. Symptoms such as persistent and sudden instances of diarrhea prevent or present a barrier to individual freedom, happiness, and productivity. Because of symptoms such as the urgent need to use a restroom, Crohn's disease can have implications on employment, social interactions, and self-image. This proposal will help to alleviate some of the anxiety and embarrassment Crohn's sufferers experience when restroom emergencies occur outside of the home. And with me today is Bridget Aldred, who suffers from ulcerative colitis, and she will help committee members understand why this legislation is needed and how it will help her have peace of mind when she is at the mall, restaurants, and other retail establishments. And I think she's an awful brave young woman to be here today, and so I appreciate her being willing to come and testify on behalf of this bill.
Ms. Aldred, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Yep. You can say your name. And then,
yeah. My name is Bridget Aldred.
Then you can testify.
I'm here to talk on behalf of all kids and adults who suffer with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, also known as inflammatory bowel disease, or I'll just call it IBD. When I was 9 years old in 1998, I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, for which there is no cure and no cause for. I went through over 30 hospitalizations, 6 surgeries, a PICC line, dietary restrictions, and homeschool. And not to mention, I didn't have any friends, and I wasn't a normal 9-year-old girl. The painful medication side effects included weight gain, a big moon face, and hair loss from the steroid dependency and the chemotherapy. I was forced to take high doses of steroids just to keep me alive. When I was 12 years old, I had total colon removal, and I lived with an ileostomy bag for 4 months. Basically, it was really hard for have the ileostomy bag just because of it. I had a lot of complications with it, and it also, you know, just because I wasn't going to the bathroom normally, I still had to make it to the bathroom to empty my bag and when it was leaking and that kind of things. And then in March of 2002, I had the takedown and I had my ileostomy bag removed. Basically, I just want you to put yourself in my shoes for a minute. Just imagine that you're this teenage girl, you're out shopping with your friends at the mall, and all of a sudden you need to go to the bathroom, like now. You can't wait, you have to go. You're standing there in absolute excruciating pain and discomfort, and you go up to a employee, and I showed him this card here, and I say, you know, I need to use the bathroom right now, I have a medical condition, and they say, no, you have to, you know, our bathroom's only for employees. You need to go to the other side of the mall, and to the left, to the right, and up about 12 stairs to get to the bathroom. Just imagine, you know, being in that pain, you can't wait, making it and not being able to make it to the bathroom. How humiliating that is to, you know, go up to your friends and say, we need to go, I just had an accident. I mean, what normal teenager has an accident in the middle of a mall? It's absolutely humiliating. So regardless of what many people may think, people with IBD are not faking it. We cannot fix it, and changing our diet will not change the urgency we have. We will always have that urgency no matter what we eat. I just don't understand why anybody would want to fake this kind of disease. Why would you want to have an accident in the middle of a mall? Why would you want to spend half the day in the bathroom or not have any friends or be in excruciating pain? Kind of an example is my best friend Tara. I met her at the CCFA camp, and she's had an ileostomy bag for about 6 years now. She is 17 years old. It's the same thing for her. When her bag fills up, she needs to go to the bathroom now. It kills me to have to see her, you know, running to the bathroom, holding her leaking bag, hoping that nobody notices that there's stool leaking all over her side, all because somebody wouldn't let her use the bathroom. And also, my aunt has IBD, and she's pregnant. And I just can't imagine, you know, having to go to the bathroom. You know, when you're pregnant, you go to the bathroom a lot anyways. And then having both of them, and then, you know, how is a pregnant lady supposed to run halfway down the mall to get to the bathroom? So it kind of saddens me to know that there are people out there that are uninformed about IBD. If they only really knew how much this bill would help us, we could actually enjoy our time out in public and want to go places. Let's see. basically changing our diet and our stress level is not the answer to the disease, but if we have less stress about going out in public, it'll also help. So I ask you please to think about someone, think about a little kid, think about a teenager running to the bathroom, and pass this bill so you can help us.
Ms. Aldred, thank you. I think any one of us can relate to how frightening that has to be for you, even though I have not been familiar with these conditions. I've heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for sharing your really personal story, and it really helps us. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Bridget. My daughter has been diagnosed with Crohn's since 2002, and I totally understand. She had three surgeries in her first year. Thank you for your testimony. It was difficult,
super.
I'm sure. But my question, and I think you've answered it, is how do you, Senator Prettner-Solon, let a clerk or someone know that you have a condition?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I have with me also Jim Fennell. Fennell from the Crohn's mm-hmm. Foundation, and he can answer some of those questions for you.
Mr. Fennell, welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. Actually, I didn't come with a prepared presentation, but actually to come to affirm Bridget's attendance here, and she is definitely one of our stars. But CCFA, when you become a member of CCFA, we issue a membership card. And on that membership card, it says, because I have a medical condition, I need to use the bathroom now.
Mr. Fennell, I'll draw attention. In the package
you
gave us,
thank you,
is
ma'am.
A sample of that card.
Thank you very much.
A little over on the left side. And then, I mean, that has a lot of impact if you look at the
exactly
the ad for the organization as well. Feel free to continue.
As the director of this foundation, I wear a couple hats. Not only one of as an administrative assistant to the our national Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, but I also have two adult children, and so like yourself, I've witnessed their pain and. Plus many, many other people. In the state of Minnesota, we estimate 30,000 to 35,000 people diagnosed with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis from the age of 1 up to the age of 81. So this disease sees no limit in terms of age discrimination at all. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of adults in this state, in this city, in the metropolitan area, that just simply don't leave their homes because they're afraid. They can't function, and it becomes very debilitating. And so our effort is to hopefully motivate all of you to see that this bill be passed. And I must admit, I have a lot of people coming up to me every day saying, well, it's common sense. Why do we need a law? Another legal thing to box us in and to make government bigger than what government should be doing in our personal lives. But the reality is people who have this disease, or if you don't, if anyone in this room has suffered from prostate cancer or enlarged prostate, and you have to go to the bathroom right away, you have to run. You can't just, and many times people are refused, adults and children, and embarrassing things happen. As you know in your notes, we have over 1.4 million people in the United States diagnosed. Many are not diagnosed. Many of us think it's the flu and it's passing. People stop eating for 2 or 3 days, but they have the disease. 30,000 here. There's no cure. And that's the sad part of this. There's no cure. And so Our hope as a foundation is to improve the quality of life of each person diagnosed with this disease. And one way to do that is to pass this bill. It's very important. Thank you.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I was to play the devil's advocate and speak for retailers, I would be concerned about liability issues. Senator Prettner-Solon, does this bill speak to that?
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Scogin. If you look on the second page, line 2.7, there is a subdivision 4 addresses liability. And it states that the retailer will not be liable. I don't know if you can address that better.
I think, as I understand this bill, it's that a retailer is not liable. I mean, in terms of they don't have to expand their bathroom, add any additional cost to the retailer. It's just simply their employees use that bathroom. So if their employees use that bathroom, we assume it's okay for us to use the bathroom.
But Madam Chair and Senator Scogin,
Prettner-Solin.
Also, they are not liable for any injury that would occur to the patron in the use of that facility either.
Senator Scogin.
Just a follow-up, just in regards to that, at work, in our bathroom, we have cleaning supplies out. We have towels stacked up just because the employees know that that's part of the storage area. Our retailers expected to keep their washrooms then more clean, or if they feel there's a potential for a problem?
No. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Scogin, no. You'll note on line 2.16, or 16 on page 2, B, it says a retail establishment is not required to make any physical changes to an employee toilet facility under this act.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin, first I would also really like to commend your witness. I think she did just a wonderful job. And I think the fact that this is a difficult thing for all of us to talk about, and especially for a young person like her to come and be publicly explaining what this is like, just highlights the need for this type of a bill, because for young people to be in the situation of having to describe or discuss something that can be difficult and embarrassing is probably one of the reasons why we need to try to make this a simpler process for them. All of that being said, I'm going to ask the question kind of from the opposite perspective of what was just raised by Senator Scogin. My concern or my understanding is that Subdivision 4 regarding liability would not hold the owner responsible unless you were able to, if there were an injury or even a death, unless you were the person who was injured or died could prove willful or gross negligence, which is a very high standard to meet. And my concern is that people who are in this situation, we're not requiring owners to make any changes, and so if we were to judge their behavior just on a general negligence standard, the same protection that everyone else has, the same protection we give all other citizens of our state, it would be in the context of not requiring them to make any new changes. And I guess I'm feeling that people in this situation deserve that protection. Whether retailers are especially happy with that, I would prefer to vote for this legislation with a regular general negligence standard to be applied.
Is that a question or just a comment?
So I guess my question is, why aren't we just using a regular negligence standard? Was it felt that it was necessary to have this in there in order to get this bill passed, or why is that?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Prettner-Solin.
I know that we're being required to go to judiciary after this, and so I'm sure that this is the same question they have. And I know that I would like to meet with both the retailers and the trial lawyers to try to figure out how what would be acceptable language here.
Yeah. Senator Prettner-Solin, Senator Olson, the bill will, if we pass it, will go to judiciary. And as well as we're going to have some testimony from some people representing retail establishments here. So we may be, you may be able to ask a question then, or they may share their concerns with us. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is this card. In the four or 5 years I've been going to my doctor's appointments, I've never, probably not paying close enough attention, seen this organization. And I think the card needs to be very easily available. I don't need to join another organization.
Right.
If we pass the legislation, I somehow get that card into the patient's hand at the doctor's meeting.
Right. I agree. Yeah, I think
Fennell.
I think every patient that is diagnosed with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis obviously works with their gastroenterologist, and at that place, that's when patients receive information on not only on CCFA, but this card could be given to that person at that time, so they would have easily have accessibility to it.
Mr. Fennell, do you communicate with gastroenterologists in some fashion, I assume, and
yeah.
you would alert them to if we were to change the law, if the legislature
decides
to do
that? Yes, we have. Of course, we're blessed in Minnesota to have the largest gastroenterologist group in the world, a Minnesota Gastro, but we also have another dedicated 100 or so other GI physicians that CCFA works with on a monthly basis, actually, in communication.
Any other questions, members? I think there are some people that wanted to, or at least someone, a person who wanted to speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay close
Madam
if there's
Chair.
Any questions.
Thank
but
you.
Mr. Hickey, are you here? And I don't have anybody else scheduled to speak, but if you'd like to, when Mr. Hickey's done, feel free to come forward. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thanks. Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I just wanted to make a few comments about the bill today. It's hard to understand how somebody would deny somebody bathroom access when they're clearly having some type of a medical related emergency. It's pretty insensitive, but it sounds like there are some examples out there. I think the one thing that this committee and the legislators should look at, though, is how many actual examples do we have? And I don't know if Senator Pretner Solon has a list or if the advocates have a list, but before we get into this kind of mandate complete with criminal penalty, it would be nice to know what's the actual documented need for this. And certainly it's a dire one, and I think we'll all be very sympathetic to it. I also think that we got to take a hard look at what we're doing here. It's inconsiderate, and I think it's insensitive to deny somebody a bathroom when they really need it, but should that really be a criminal penalty? And that is concerning to us that we're putting that in here. Regarding the liability provision, appreciate whatever liability protection might be put in here. I think you have to realize that these are not bathrooms available to the public. They could be down the stairs. They could be in a dark area. They might not be clean. And for a whole host of reasons, that might be why some of these merchants and whatever documented examples there are not giving people access. They might feel a little embarrassed about what their bathroom looks like, or it's certainly not available to the public, although when I weigh it personally, I think you should allow the person who's having an emergency to use it regardless what it looks like. But I think that is one of the reasons for the liability provision is to give a little extra protection. I don't totally understand it. Maybe I need to hear the discussion in judiciary myself. But if you're going to be sending somebody into a bathroom that's normally not used, there might be some possibility of somebody stumbling down dark steps or whatever. And so appreciate that provision. But I do think we need to try to document the need, and I don't think we should be penalizing people who, with a criminal penalty, who are maybe insensitive and don't allow somebody to use a bathroom. Appreciate the time to talk.
Senator Vandeveer, did you have a question for
Mr. Hickey? Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Mr. Hickey, I'm wondering regarding the liability issue, because the only concern I have is that if the bill leaves here and then it goes to judiciary and there's some liability, this seems to deal with that, because these are essentially private restrooms almost that they weren't intended for the public, and I'm just concerned that the liability issue will resurface after it gets out of here. Is that would be pretty important, wouldn't it, in this legislation, that with regard to these bathrooms?
Mr. Hickey.
Oh, I agree. If we're going to go ahead with this, I mean, I appreciate the fact that was put in, and we should certainly retain it.
Thank you.
We're talking about an emergency situation. We're not talking about a bathroom that was planned to be made available to the public. And I bet you're going to find a lot of them to be dirty and dimly lit and, you know, not the way you would expect to see it if it was available to the public.
And I guess one more question, Madam Chair. Regarding the penalty, is a petty misdemeanor and $100 fine, is this civil, or you said it was criminal?
It's not criminal.
Mr. Hickey.
Petty misdemeanor is clearly criminal. Senator Vanderveer.
You don't call it criminal.
Mr. Hickey, I don't think that a petty misdemeanor is considered criminal. But.
Well, how, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Vanderveer.
Maybe to the author, do you view this as criminal, or is this just the lowest penalty you can? Isn't a petty misdemeanor as low as you could go?
Senator Prentner-Solon.
I think perhaps I'll ask for advice on that. I think it is the lowest, but maybe somebody can help
Senator
me.
Senator Marty, maybe can.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, yeah, petty misdemeanor is the lowest, but you can set a maximum fine of $25 or whatever you wanted.
Okay.
In other words, you'd probably want to say a petty misdemeanor, not fine, not to exceed $25 or whatever you wanted.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Hickey.
I just made my comments in the context of a petty misdemeanor versus a fine, a civil fine of some reason, you know, from a state agency using whatever authority versus this is the petty misdemeanor, this is equivalent to your driver's, you know, getting a ticket. So I think it is criminal, but it's at the bottom of the food chain. Maybe I'm wrong.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I think you're partially correct. I think it falls within the statutes that govern crimes. But, for example, if you were asked if you've ever been convicted of a crime, this wouldn't be considered a crime under that type of a definition.
Okay. So, and Senator Olson and I both serve on judiciary. So, Mr. Hickey, I assume you would be welcome to testify, you know, there as well. Committee does pass the bill, obviously. Senator, is there anyone else? Pardon me.
We're just going to.
Okay. Here, let me read to you, to members, 60902.
Okay. For now.
Sub 4A, petty misdemeanor means a petty offense which is prohibited by statute, which does not constitute a crime, and for which a sentence of a fine of not more than $300 may be imposed. Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. For your record, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm watching this issue on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. And I would just say generally, Madam Chairman and members, we have supported a number of immunity provisions that promote and provide a public benefit, that provide an appropriate level of protection. And we've tended to oppose immunity provisions that simply grant protection for someone's negligent conduct. We think that this bill falls into the former category. It does promote a public benefit, and the only issue that we would have is to make certain that the protection that is provided is consistent with the conduct involved. And in judiciary, we'll certainly look at that negligence standard versus gross negligence or willful conduct, which is essentially taking action to hurt someone directly. We think that may be a little too high, but we've been working with the proponents of the bill, and we think that we can come to an agreement on language that will work for everyone.
Okay, Mr. Carlson, and I'd feel much more comfortable as chair of the Commerce Committee and watching some committees lately. I would like to see committees deal with the subject matter over which they have jurisdiction. I feel very strongly about that. So the chair is going to suggest I would like that to be the subject for the Judiciary Committee, if that's agreeable to members. I little editorial comment never hurt anybody, right? Except maybe the person making it. But thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Carlson.
Manager.
Thank
Madam
you.
Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the room who would like to speak to this? Anyone else for or against it?
She can make her own motion.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
So, Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File number 140 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
On Senator Solon's motion that Senate File 140 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Prentner-Solon, thank you. And thank you to your witnesses, Ms. Albright and Mr. Fennell. Thank you.
Put the body piercing.
Senator Sparks. Let's see, who's... Oh, yeah, we have two committee members. Who's the next person? Is Senator Olson here?
No. He's in another room.
Okay. Are we going to get him one more? Okay, that's fine. Then Senator Sparks.
Sure.
representing any of that. Senator Sparks, the first of one or two bills before our committee.
We will have a few, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to present Senate File 128, the Vehicle Protection Act. Before we get started, Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that would put the bill in the
shape. Yes, and I believe the members have that. Author's amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like. It's the A1 short. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment, A1 amendment, is adopted. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And today we're here, like I said, with Senate File 128, the Vehicle Protection Act. This legislation clarifies how vehicle protection products sold with warranties will be treated in the marketplace. Examples of vehicle protection products include alarm systems, body parts, marking products such as glass etching, satellite tracking systems, and other similar anti-theft devices.
Senator Sparks, the body parts are the automobile body.
Yeah. Well, yes. That, the next bill will deal with the body piercing.
There were some quizzical looks around the table.
Thank you for clarification.
Thank you. This legislation provides that the warrantors of these products will register with the state, demonstrate the financial ability to cover their warranty obligations, and provide disclaimers that claim procedure information in the warranty agreements. The financial responsibility requirements, disclosures, and disclaimers will significantly protect consumers who purchase these products. These regulations are easy to administer and do not impose a significant burden on the businesses who provide vehicle protection products with warranties or on the regulatory agency that administers this process. With me today, Madam Chair and members, are Paul Cassidy, Kelly Wolf, and Victor Smith to testify in support of this legislation. Mr. Smith is the Executive Director of the National Vehicle Protection Association, which is a trade association representing businesses engaged in the production, manufacturing, distribution, or installation of vehicle products. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to turn over to Mr. Cassidy, who will give you a brief overview of the bill, and then Mr. Smith will walk you through the actual legislation.
Mr. Cassidy, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. I'm here on behalf of the National Vehicle Protection Association today, which is a trade association of manufacturers who produce and distribute automobile anti-theft products. With me today also, as Senator Sparks mentioned, is Victor Smith, the executive director of the NVPA. We'll provide an overview of the bill as soon as I conclude my my overview. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, there are well over 204 million vehicles in the United States. That's and 191 million drivers as well in the United States. That means there are more cars than people in this country at this time. In Minnesota, over 14,000 motor vehicle thefts occurred in 2005, costing consumers tens of millions of dollars in lost claims. As a result of anti-theft products are becoming increasingly popular with consumers. Examples of anti-theft products are vehicle identification systems such as body parts, vehicle marking products, and window etching products. Steering wheel locks that you've probably heard of, such as the club, alarm systems, ignition disablers, and satellite and radio tracking systems. All of these are products that you can purchase from your automobile dealer when you purchase a vehicle. Automobile anti-theft products have a proven track record of deterring theft and recovering vehicles in the case of theft. For example, American Family Insurance Company reported that etched vehicles have a theft claim frequency 43% lower than that of vehicles without etching. National Car Rental Company reported the theft frequency declined 85% after their Cleveland fleets were marked. The Chicago fleet experienced a 30% increase in recovery rate after they had been marked. The facts speak for themselves. Amateur and professional thieves alike simply move on if a car is known to be protected by one of these products. In fact, I could also like to point out that in Minnesota statutes in Chapter 65B recognizes the value of anti-theft protection devices and mandates a premium reduction for certain devices on your auto policies. The products covered by the proposed legislation are anti-theft products with warranties that typically provide up to $5,000 in coverage in the event that the product fails to prevent your car from being stolen. Products deter the theft of vehicles, assist in their recovery if stolen, and in the case of product failure, the product warranty protects consumers from the losses associated with the theft to the extent that the consumer's loss exceeds the vehicle's insurance coverage. Here's the purpose of the bill. The purpose of the bill is to offer consumers a viable market of vehicle protection products with an appropriate level of mandated consumer product disclosures at the time of the sale, and a solid level of financial viability behind the product. Number two, protect consumers by requiring all manufacturers and distributors of vehicle protection products to acquire and maintain a warranty liability reimbursement insurance policy or to have a minimum net worth of $50 million to make sure the warranties are financially able to put the warrantors are financially able to pay their claims. And number three, the legislation provides auto dealers with the assurance that they are selling a viable product to their customers, backed by a company with the financial viability to stand behind their warranty and pay claims in the event of loss. The National Vehicle Protection Model Act has now been adopted in 16 states, including our neighboring state of Wisconsin, Massachusetts, California, Florida, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas. You'll also note that there's a letter in your packet from the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association endorsing this legislation. Centerfile 128 attempts to establish certainty in the market for consumers and auto dealers alike concerning treatment of anti-theft products and to protect consumers from warrantors whose financial condition might not be sufficiently sound to make good on their product's warranty when it comes time to pay a claim. The bill creates a very simple compliance structure. Product warrantors register with the Department of Commerce and demonstrate financial responsibility through the use of a reimbursement insurance policy or demonstration of a net worth of $50 million or more. Vehicle protection products are commonly sold with warranties that make claims to the consumer about the performance of the product. The warranties are not sold separately or apart from the sale of a vehicle protection product. The bill would establish specific recognition in Minnesota statutes for theft deterrent products sold with warranties. Many manufacturers offer consumers a warranty with their product that provides assistance with costs associated with the theft of their vehicle. Examples of these costs include reimbursement for the insurance policy deductible, assistance with renting a replacement vehicle, license fees and sales tax for the replacement vehicle, and other costs not covered by insurance. Receiving a money-back guarantee or mere replacement of a defective product hardly assists those who had their auto stolen. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to now have Mr. Smith briefly walk you through the bill, and then we would stand for any questions you might have. Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy, thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Smith. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time this afternoon. My name is Victor Smith. I'm here from just down the road from San Antonio, Texas. It is a little south of Austin, but a different Austin, I guess. Thank you again for your attention to what we're proposing. This bill is fairly straightforward. It's very similar to what you do as an automobile owner. You have to, when you have a vehicle, you have to register with the state, you show proof of insurance, and you're good to go. That's basically what we proposed in 16 other states, as you've heard, and that's what we're proposing here in Minnesota. Our bill is a fairly simple structure. And in walking through the provisions of it, the first section of importance is a definition. It just defines who's involved, what type of products are regulated, and basically this involves what we call vehicle protection products, which are primarily anti-theft devices that are sold with a warranty that if your vehicle is stolen and this device doesn't aid in its recovery within basically 30 days, then you are paid compensation for the damages we know that you will incur if the device doesn't perform as warranted. It's not intended to prevent anyone from entering the market selling these products. It's not intended to be a barrier. Anybody that sells a product still can. If they sell a warranty, they just have to register and show the proof of insurance or the financial responsibility that this bill requires. If you sell the product with the warranty, you're required to register, and that's basically the gist of the bill. The Section 4 talks about the registration and filing requirements. The form used in most states is about a half or a three-quarter page form that has primarily the name, address, contact information for the registration. Then you file your proof of insurance, which, for example, Texas provides a standard endorsement form that a warrantor can use, add to their warranty reimbursement insurance policy, and file that with the state and file copies of the warranties, and they're good to go. So the final section talks about Section 5 talks about the financial responsibility required. So you buy warranty liability insurance policy to back up your warranty. And so if the warrantor can't perform financially, then there's an insurance company standing behind them. So the consumer is protected. They're protected in this bill through the disclosures they receive. They're protected through the financial responsibility requirement. And they're protected because there's an insurance company standing behind that warrantor. The sixth section talks about some of the policy requirements. One of the things that we think is a big benefit to the consumer is if they file a claim with the warrantor and the warrantor doesn't perform on the claim, they can file a claim then directly with the insurance company that backs that warranty liability. And that insurer's information has to be disclosed to the consumer at the time they receive the product. So that's a real plus for a consumer that may feel like they're getting a bit of a runaround from a warrantor. Section 7 has several detailed disclosures so that the consumer knows what type of product they're buying, that it is a warranty, it's not insurance, that it tells them who the parties are and what their obligations are, so it's fairly standard. And the balance of the act really is just administrative and implementation that I think you all can review if you'd like. It's not terribly exciting. But I know everyone kind of looks askance when you come to a committee and say, hey, we've got a deal that's fair to the industry, fair to the consumers, and it's not that big an administrative burden. And I am saying that, and I think if you understand this bill, you'll see that it really is fair to all parties. It's beneficial to the dealers because they know how these products are going to be sold, and it's beneficial to consumers because there's a very substantive protections for them to make sure that they are paid and not left holding the bag if something happens. This is very similar to what's happened in the service contract industry, and you all passed legislation here, I guess, three years ago to address that very question. So there have been some pretty well-known bankruptcies in the service contract industry. We're thankful that we haven't incurred that, but we want to make sure that it doesn't happen in our industry. So I'd be glad to respond to any questions. Thank you very much for your time and urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sparks, I don't want to sound really ignorant, but what is etching or marking?
Don't you go ahead.
Mr. Smith, Chairman, maybe is going to answer that.
Body parts marking is they use chemicals to basically put a small numerical code or paint in the body parts of the car, maybe in the hidden parts of the door or underneath the fenders or places where you take a black light and if you shine it over it, there's a sticker that indicates that there's marking under it. So even if a thief were to try and take that sticker off, that light would show it. Window etching is chemically or using a laser to etch a code number and a phone number in the glass, all six pieces of glass on a car. So, and then they put a warning sticker on the window, so a thief that looks at that is going to recognize that if they steal the car, they have to dispose of the glass, which is commonly resold to glass dealers, and they can't even leave it around the chop shop because that piece will trace them back to the original car that was stolen.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much does something like that cost?
Madam Chairman, Senator, the dealers sell it generally from anywhere from $100 to $200. $150.
All six windows?
Senator
yeah.
Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Pretty simple procedure.
Mr. Smith, are these products being sold in Minnesota now?
And, yes, ma'am.
And with the warranties?
Madam Chair, they are currently being sold with warranties, and they're primarily sold through new car dealerships, and some used car dealers also offer them. Some of the products are just sold in general retail, but that primarily is through the automobile dealerships.
Okay. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I don't have any big problems with what the language of the bill is that I've been able to see or anything, and I read the fact sheet on why it's needed. The only thing I can't figure out is, I mean, are companies like the club and saying some of these products saying, well, we will warranty if the car is stolen, we'll replace the value of the car. Are there companies who are failing to do that? I mean, I haven't heard a widespread people who are violating what this would prohibit them from doing. I understand why you want to have insurance to make sure that they can meet what they promise. I don't have any problem with that. I'm just wondering, I've never heard of a company promising this and not delivering it.
Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, Senator, We're fortunate, I think, in our industry that for the most part there aren't a whole lot of consumer complaints for people not being paid these type of claims for under warranty like this. Unfortunately, I think, you know, 4 years ago you probably would have had a similar experience in the service contract industry. We also are concerned that in some lawsuits that there are claims that the warranty really isn't a warranty, that it's insurance. And so the dealers have questions about how it will be treated, and this is a clarification of that issue. And it makes it certain that a dealer knows how the product is going to be treated legally and the consumer will be paid on any claims that they receive.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I can see how service contracts, I mean, I think you could predict that would be a problem. The only comment I guess I'd have is, well, I don't have any problem with this. It strikes me as a problem that might someday happen, and so we're going to prevent it from happening. And I guess I remember when Minnesota statutes were 4 volumes long, and now they're
18, 15.
And
Senator Marty, you don't really remember when they were.
I do remember.
No.
I do. You were in the legislature.
No,
then,
I wasn't.
Yes, you were. 1980 they were. 4 volumes. Anyway, they have exploded, and it's because of things like this. And again, I'll support this. I just am not sure that we're fixing a problem that might occur. And I'm not saying it hasn't ever occurred. I just think we're more proactive in this one than in a lot of areas where we refuse to be proactive altogether. But it's just a general comment.
Well, Senator Marty, thank you. Earlier, Mr. Cassidy said there was a letter from the auto dealers, and I don't see that.
I apologize.
Might that have something? I mean, I don't know if the auto dealers feel they would be more comfortable selling these products if they were knew this.
Madam Chairman,
backing it up.
Mr.
Smith,
I believe the auto dealers. We've been in close contact with them. We always work closely. They do support it very strongly, and I think part of the reason we are being maybe a little proactive is that this is a very popular product, and it's being sold more and more in the state. And our concern is really that it be treated uniformly nationwide, and also that there not be problems develop. It's much easier for us to address this problem in advance, and we're not trying to add a great volume or a heavy weight of regulation. This really is, you know, make copies of your warranties, slap an endorsement on your insurance policy, file a half-page registration with the state, and you're good to go. So it's interesting. We have run into some states where these products were deemed to be insurance, and we've worked aggressively through legislation to resolve that and get them treated exactly as we presented here. Other states say, there's no way this is insurance. This is clearly a warranty. And there's no reason for anyone to think that it would be otherwise. But those two extremes make it difficult for a dealer to know how the product's going to be treated, and it also makes it difficult for our members, the warrantors, to be sure that they are treated uniformly, you know, nationwide, and that's very important.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, would this how would the consumer know how to get the information to contact the insurance company? Would they have to contact the department and you'd provide that information? Or would it be on the warranty itself? Or how would a person even know this existed?
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chairman and Senator Olson, the disclaimers require that the warrantor be identified and the company backing up the warranty liability, the insurance company. So all the claims information and a phone number to contact both the warrantor and the insurance company and addresses are required to be provided to the consumer at the time they purchase it. So that's one of the good disclosures that are required under this bill.
Any other questions? Do you have anybody else to testify, Senator Sparks?
Madam Chair, no, that would be the end of our testimony. I do believe the department's here, and they might like to add some comments.
And I did want to ask
right.
Someone representing the department how they feel about this legislation. Mr. Nelson, welcome. Are you Deputy Commissioner?
Madam Chair, yes. Hello. Thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Pat Nelson. I'm a Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Commerce. I was interested in the discussion here this morning or this afternoon, and Senator Marty's comments in particular. Conceptually, I think this legislation does clear up the notion about whether this is insurance, and I understand why the author of the bill and the industry would like that clarification. I think in Minnesota we have a very broad definition of insurance, and certainly if we saw problems in this area, we could use the definition of insurance to try and affect consumer protection. But as Senator Marty said, and we concur, we haven't found a lot of problems, or we don't know of any problems in this particular area of warranty. And it's interesting to note that unlike service contracts, the warranty here attaches to a physical product, and it's not purchased to get the protection. So it's kind of once removed from standard insurance, and also to some degree, whether they performed or not, you still got the physical product that you bought. And so here we're building a statutory scheme, and we're giving it the sort of the imprimatur of government. And I don't know whether we're legitimizing it past the relative worth to society of this product. So that being said, the Commerce Department could administer. I mean, this is not a bill that we couldn't manage, because as the author and testifiers pointed out, it's a pretty simple regulatory scheme, but we would have to do some work to administer it. So, I mean, going forward, we might want to work with the author and industry to maybe even simplify it a little more, because as the balance is, of course, consumer protection versus, you know, being so proactive in this area, when I don't know that we've seen a lot of problems. But I do understand their need to clarify its legal status, because we would argue that with absent something like this, we could call it insurance. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Nelson, do you think there would be a cost? You know, there's a fee in here, a registration fee of $250 annually. To the department. I have no clue how many, you know, entities would be filing. What do you think about cost, fiscal note, for example?
Madam Chair, we cost to us, I don't know that I have a good idea of how many of these would ask to be registered. So if we could get some information on that.
Mr. Cassidy, can you enlighten us?
Madam Chair, Senators, possibly 20, maybe 30 companies would qualify under this legislation to register in the state of Minnesota, given the financial requirements.
So that would be about $5,000 or so, right, to the department to...
Madam Chair, Senators,
I don't know.
I don't think, given the requirements of the legislation and the registration requirements, that it would be a lot of work. So I think that the registration fee warrants what the cost would be to administer the legislation or the regulation.
Yeah,
and we would certainly, moving forward, discuss that with Deputy Commissioner Nelson as we go into the finance realm,
yes,
of the legislative session.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Any questions for the Deputy Commissioner? Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Is there anybody else in the room? Ms. Schlander, are you... The auto dealers don't. Anybody else like to speak? Okay.
Then, Madam Chair, obviously I appreciate the department's comments. I did talk with them before the bill. Obviously, I've had a good working relationship with them, and obviously with the understanding moving forward, this bill, if it does pass out of this committee, needs to go judiciary. So I will certainly promise to continue to work with them as we move forward. But if there's no further discussion, I would move that Senate File 128, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Did we get a request from Judiciary, and is there something in here? Mr. Cassidy, did you think that it needed to go to Judiciary?
Madam Chair, members, I certainly don't, but members...
I think they would finance.
Madam Chair, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I think finance. Mr. Stang thinks that finance might be a place where that we should. Oh, just a minute. I'm sorry, on the last page, we didn't take away that. We did delete section 11, I know that,
maybe,
but.
Maybe 12 right now. It's pretty.
Yeah, with the black light.
Oh, yeah, admissibility.
You know, I think that maybe section 12 is going to mean it should go to judiciary.
Madam Chair, section 12 just, I don't know how key it is to the bill, but. It talks about certain things not being admissible in court before the effective date of this bill and so forth. So that sounds like judiciary stuff to me.
Okay. So Senator Sparks was right. He's moved that Senate File 128 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. And as amended, did I not say?
Right.
I'm sorry. Senate File 128 is amended. Is there any further discussion? Members, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you,
thank
Madam
you,
Chair.
Mr. Cassidy. Mr. Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Stick around. We'll have a little more snow for you.
I'm enjoying it.
And Senator Olsen. I saw it. There he is, waiting patiently. Welcome to our Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. How are you this afternoon?
Madam Chair, it's my pleasure to be here today. And I have a bill that is Senate File 112, and that's growing out of a constituent's concern that her daughter came home with a belly piercing and upon investigating further found that there is no regulations on body piercings. So we've drafted this bill that addresses for persons under the age of 18 to have a body piercing except for their lower or their earlobe, the proprietor would need to witness a signature by the person's parent or guardian. So that's kind of the bill in a nutshell.
Madam Chair.
Aye.
So Senator Olsen, you couldn't just take a note. You'd have to be there to sign it because it has to be signed and dated in the presence
Madam
of the
Chair,
person performing the piercing.
We that is correct. We drafted some language. The tanning bill is actually at age 16 and under, you have to have a parent or guardian, the proprietor has to witness the signature. On the tattoo bill, for someone under age 18, they just need to have a note. And I suspect there's a lot of best friends that are writing notes. So I think this.
Oh, my goodness. What do you think? Yes, Senator Olsen.
That's all I had.
Okay. Senator Johnson, do you have a question?
Yeah, actually I have many, Senator, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I hate to admit this, but just recently I was in a tattoo and piercing shop with one of my children. And not only wouldn't they allow the piercing without my presence, they seen both of our driver's license to make sure we had the same last name and same address. And we signed legal papers. So I'm not sure that we don't have this in law already.
I don't think we have it in law, but Senator Olsen, did you have some?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just going to offer to speculate with respect to what you're seeing, but my guess is that they did that for liability reasons, to protect themselves in case something happened, that they wanted the parents' consent for liability reasons, because a minor wouldn't be able to waive any release from liability that they might be giving, but an adult could do that. So so that's just my guess, and I know that I'd also gotten some before I signed on this bill.
Senator Marty,
I think
so
I lost my train of thought.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olsen.
If Senator Marty were to run for governor now, he might have a chance.
Oh, Senator Marty, thank you for the the visual demonstration. And hopefully we're not on television.
I checked.
You did your check? Oh, good.
Madam
yes,
Chair.
Senator Olsen.
And also, just in, I think most people do believe what Senator Johnson just said, I think it surprises most people to know that we don't have a law that regulates this in terms of parental consent.
I am surprised. That's right.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an interest in this, too, Senator Olsen. And for the last couple of years, I've had a bill to regulate the tattooing industry, actually to license them, because there are no requirements. There's nothing about sterilization. There's nothing about taking care of the needles. There's no requirements about any of that. And I intend to bring those bills forward again next year. I didn't this year, but I think that it's an industry that certainly bears looking into because, I mean, certainly with the how we can pass AIDS and other transmittable diseases through needles and everything, it is something that should be more closely monitored.
Senator Johnson, I think that maybe you just went to a really professional, reputable place. Now I'm going to really embarrass you.
Senator Johnson. Madam Chair, not only did we go through all those legalities and paperwork procedures, the room was sterilized. The pieces of instruments came out of packaged, and the hand washing and the just incredible amount of effort was put into the whole procedure. I almost thought I got my $40 worth.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
And Senator Johnson, there are some counties that do have regulations, but there is no
that's
statewide.
What it is.
And Minneapolis.
And Senator Johnson thinks that's what it was, in Anoka County. Okay. I wonder, Senator Marty, did you wish to move the bill?
Madam Chair, I was going to move the bill.
I suspect your father would not have approved. But I just.
I'm over
18
now.
I think he still might try to stop you. I certainly will speak up for that anyway.
You didn't think it was becoming?
No. So, is there anybody here that would like to speak to the bill in opposition or in favor of the bill? Nobody here wished to do that. Senator Marty, did you say you would move that Senate File 112?
You recommend, you recommend
to pass.
Don't move. Do they have to go anywhere else?
And it goes to the floor.
No, to the floor.
With misdemeanor?
I'm pretty sure they don't have to see.
Okay.
Just straighten
the sign. Misdemeanor, you don't need to see? Okay, then it would go to the floor. On that motion, any questions or discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
You're going to have real fun with this, I can tell. And members, on Thursday we will hear a bill from Senator Johnson. It's the Weights and Measures bill. And I have a bill which I'm thinking I will try to amend to your bill that has to do with paying attention at the gas pump, if that's all right. And Senator Tomasoni has Senate File 805, regulating health plan coverage for hearing aids. Senator Limmer has Senate File 241 regarding information about a mortgage application. And with that, I will say the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members. Yes, you may.